Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Wandering Road Podcast. I'm your host Chris, alongside my co-host Dean, and for today's show, we're going to be covering one of modern history's most mysterious and controversial events. Back in 1959, in the Ural Mountains, a group of hikers mysteriously died. And today's show is just about that. The Dyatlov Pass incident. But before we get started with today's show, if you would like to be on the show, please reach us at our email address, twroadpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. As of recently, I had someone reach out saying that they want to send us a voice message of their story. So sometime in the future, we'll have that listener episode ready for everyone. Like I said, if you want to reach us, feel free to reach out to us on our social media or just send us an email. We'd love to have you. And again, that email address is twroadpodcast@gmail.com. And with that, we'll start today's show. How you doing today, buddy?
I'm good, man. I still think it's so strange that we have listeners.
Like, I know.
Mean, it's like we're normal people, right? And of course, we're nowhere near famous or popular or anything like that yet. But it's just weird to think that, like, oh, there are people out there listening and then like want to share stories with us. So we must be doing something right a little bit. So that's kind of, there's some positivity there.
Yeah, I think so. And I took a look at the stats of episode 50 that we did with Trev, and it's pushing near 100 downloads. And I don't know, like, if that means like 100 people clicked on it, but like at least almost 100 people like actually downloaded it onto their physical device, which is pretty awesome. And it's actually like we got quite a few hits in Ireland. We got quite a few hits in Europe, all over the world. So that is freaking awesome. We appreciate everyone that tunes into our show. Trev, we're going to have you back on, man, because you seem to be a big hit with the listeners. I've had other podcasters in our network that are our friends reach out to me saying like, hey, can we get a hold of Trev? We want to talk to Trev.
So, no, dude, he's ours. He's ours.
Yeah, I know. I said I'll ask him. But yeah, man, it's nice to see your work getting such a good reception like that, because we put a lot of time and effort into this. And it's just, like you said, it's just fun and therapeutic to talk about all this stuff because our wives don't want to hear this shit. But the Dyatlov Pass incident, man, I don't think we had this on our topic list. You kind of just suggested it to me, or am I thinking of that incorrectly?
There is some mystery there because it actually was in the list. So I don't know, maybe I unconsciously put it on the list. Or, that'd be really weird because I never add stuff to the list. But it was on the list, and I was just looking through, scrolling, and thinking like, oh, what should we cover? And my eyes just landed on it. And then I actually, you know, what's funny is I brought that up to you and I wasn't even remembering clearly what the case was about. And then you're the one who reminded me like, oh, no, I do know this case. It's been around for a long time. It's a very, very intriguing case. And it's like, oh, of course. Like, why? How can we not talk about this? This is just insane. So in a nutshell, the Dyatlov Pass occurred in the Ural Mountains, as you said, which is in Russia in the late 1950s. And the crux of the story is that there were 9 young, experienced hikers who were trying to go out on this big hike, which, wasn't easy. But this big hike that they were going to go on in the wintertime in the Ural Mountains, which was, you know, heavily inundated with snow and cold weather, basically they were going to get their next level of hiking. Or back then they had these certifications to where like you do like 1, 2, level 1, 2, and 3. So they were level 2, which is actually very experienced, like intermediate plus. And they were going to do this hike to get their level 3, which is like expert level. So 9 of them go out together to do this trek, which I think it seems like, based off our research, that it shouldn't have taken more than like 3 or 4 days. If I'm not sure if I'm correct on that, if you had anything, you found any more information on that, but I don't think it was supposed to take that long. But essentially, they lost one man early on, one young man who had some health issues, who actually dropped out. And that's the first thing I wanted to talk about in this conversation, is this is like a case where someone was so close to death, like so close to going through what all these other people went through, ending in their untimely demise. And just because he felt like he couldn't do it, he was going to slow them down and actually potentially hurt them, he backs out of the hike and he goes home and he waits for a telegram that never comes. And the missing telegram is actually what set off the search party for the rest of the 8 hikers. But it was 7 men remaining and 2 women who went on this hike. And I think they were all relatively young. I think most of them were in their 20s. I think a few of them were older, but generally experienced.
They were all students at the Polytechnic Institute in Sverdlovsk. I'm not gonna fucking try.
And what, now you don't speak Russian?
No, I don't. Now it's called Yekaterinburg. But yeah, I'm not gonna attempt that again. So the plan was, like you said, they started off and they boarded a train bound for Ivdel, a city in the northern Urals. And from there, they traveled by truck to Vizhai, the last inhabited settlement before they trekked into the wilderness. And that is in January 27th of 1959. So their plan was to reach Otorten, the mountain that was about 10 kilometers north of their eventual campsite. So you have this group of experienced hikers, and the leader of the group, the one that everyone relied heavily on, was Igor Dyatlov. And unfortunately, that the pass is named after him, his last name. So that's how he got that pass. I can't recall if it was called something else during the time. So Igor himself, he was a student at the Ural Polytechnic Institute, now known as the Ural Federal University. So he was actually studying radio engineering, and he was described as a diligent and capable student. And along with that, apparently he had great leadership skills, because he was chosen as the leader for the hiking expedition. And apparently these people, like these other students and hikers, really trusted him. He was involved in planning the route, organizing the supplies, and ensuring the safety of the group during the trek. And, you know, to add on to that, he was himself an experienced hiker, along with the others. He was an outdoorsman. He's hiked numerous times. He took many skiing trips. So the dude was an outdoorsman. So
why do I feel like a shitbag when you're like listing his awesomeness? And I'm sitting here. I'm sitting here thinking, like, dude, you know what we were doing in college? We were sitting on couches and playing video games and eating chips. Like, hey, do you want to go for a hike in the Ural Mountains? Dude, fuck you. Just eat your chips and drink your beer. Yeah. And then can you imagine like trying to do something like that? And I'm like, it sounds like we're not even talking grad school. We're talking undergrad here. So
undergrad,
like,
any
to have that kind of get up and go. I mean, cheers to them, even though it didn't end up well for them. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But I think that does speak to, you know, I don't know, because you can think about it from two perspectives. So the 1950s, right? It was a different time. People who were older, and when I say older, I mean like in their 20s, they were considered more adult than I think people in their 20s today are. So I think that the gravity of the severity is probably heavier back then for such a hike, because it was taken much more seriously. Nowadays, it's like, oh, we have all kinds of technology, and we can like go out and buy a $300 North Face jacket or whatever, and like a bunch of different camping equipment that'll keep us alive, and it's really not that big of a deal. But back then, they had like, if you've seen, you can go online and look up pictures, because they actually captured photos from this hike and they still have them today, like available in open source. And you can basically just see what the people looked like and the equipment they were using. And it was very crude, it seems like. So to me, that's kind of like that increases the level of seriousness for this hike. Like, yeah, they actually might go through some really difficult situations and possibly die, which is, you know, unfortunately how it turned out. But I think that's kind of different from how it is today, where it's like, oh, let's go for a hike for a couple of days, even if it's like wintertime. Like, we have all this stuff that can help protect us. And but they actually went out there with very crude equipment that probably didn't help them too much more in that cold environment than without it. And another thing that is important point of the story is that they weren't really alone up there in the Ural Mountains. When I heard this story originally, I kind of had this vision in my head, you know, before I did any kind of deep research. It's like, oh, they're just up there in the snowy mountains and there's nothing for miles and miles around. But apparently that's not true. There is wildlife, which we'll discuss at some point. Of course, I'm sure there are wolves and stuff. Actually, we should probably look into that at some point. I'm actually curious about that myself. But while I'm talking, maybe you can like peek into that and just see like what animals exist up in the Ural Mountains, because that's going to definitely factor into the story. But we do know what else was up there during that time. And there was a tribe called the Mansi tribe, M-A-N-S-I. Apparently, they occupied this portion of the mountain range and the pass that these hikers were going through. And they had this Mansi tribe had a name for where they were going through. And it's eerily called in their language, Dead Mountain. So yeah,
where they decided to pitch their last camp.
Yeah.
Right, this is at the foot of a place called Dead Mountain. Like,
this is one of those things where it's like, really? Like, you didn't see that coming? Like, you know, it's like 2020 vision. Of course, something bad is going to happen at the foot of Dead Mountain in wintertime with hikers and the freezing snow. But essentially, like we said earlier, there was a telegram that was supposed to be sent out once they completed their trek. And that telegram never came to that ninth member who broke off early. And that's what initiated the search party. And now we get to the meat of the story, which is the most interesting aspect, obviously. I'm going to toss it over to you because actually we were talking offline before we started recording. And the funny thing about this particular topic today is that I personally think being the skeptic, I actually think that there's something more to this than just them dying randomly in a really bad situation. But Mr. Chris here actually thinks that, yes, it actually is just very explainable and nothing happened that's crazy or anything like that. So like it's kind of funny how the roles are reversed. So I'll toss it over to Chris to tell the exciting part of the story.
So the timeline of events goes as such. So on January 27th, they head out and they go to Ivdel. They go by truck to Vizhai, the last inhabited settlement before they track into the wilderness. And like Dean said, you still have these tribal folks that live out in the area that still live around there in the wilderness. So, I mean, you have that, and then you have the wildlife that you could potentially encounter, which I found really interesting. Here's what you could potentially encounter in the Ural Mountains. So along with the natives that live in these little tribes around there, here's some type of animals that they would encounter in the mountains. Elks, brown bear, foxes, wolves, wolverines, lynx, squirrel, which, you know, not really a threat, a Siberian chipmunk, a flying squirrel, you know, that little fucker who just jump off a tree and just smack into your face, and reindeer. But, I mean, aside from like a brown bear and a wolf and maybe an elk or reindeer, like those other things don't,
you know. Okay, so you have brown bears, lynx, and wolves. And if you're not familiar, lynx, I think lynx are, they're large cats, but they're kind of like bobcats or smaller than a bobcat. They're not really like crazy big. So I would probably write that one off a little bit. But you're talking about,
but I think bears, they can still fuck you up though.
Yeah, I guess if they're traveling in packs and whatnot. But the one thing that we'll get to later, or actually, I'll just mention it now, is like some of the injuries that were discovered included really, really hard-hitting, terrible chest strikes. Like that's one weird consistent injury that a lot of the bodies had, which is they were struck in the chest with great force. And I don't really like, I don't give a lot of credibility to this because, you know, we're not part of the autopsy team. We don't have the autopsy reports. But basically what comes from this story is like the force that hit them in the chest should not have been able to be caused by humans. So I guess that kind of like lays into the realm of credibility for either an avalanche or an animal attack, like you said. But there's some strange aspects to the bodies that we'll get into as well. But let's build up to that first. You want to keep telling the story?
Yeah. So the 27th, they leave. From the 28th to the 31st, they start making their trek towards Otorten. And obviously they were led by, like we said earlier, Igor Dyatlov, who was an experienced and competent hiker. But on February 1st, due to deteriorating weather conditions and fatigue, which is understandable, the group decided to set up camp on the slopes of Kolat Siakal, a mountain translated as Dead Mountain, and I apologize for my pronunciation. They deviated slightly from their planned route, so I think, correct me if I'm wrong, they were a little bit north of the actual route they were supposed to take.
Correct, yeah.
Which then led them to having to camp at the foot of this mountain.
And there was also a bad storm at the time as well, right?
Right.
Isn't that they had to pitch the tent early? They weren't planning to do that.
Yes, yes. So a lot of things lined up together to go completely wrong for them. So you had the storm, you had to pitch your tent early. And they pitched their tent. On February 2nd, the group was supposed to send a telegram to their sports club when they returned. But like you said, that never happened. No immediate alarms were raised as delays were common on such expeditions. So this is on February 2nd, where they were technically supposed to send this telegram. It wasn't until late February when people started getting concerned because the group never came back. And that's when a search party was organized. And on February 26th, they discovered their abandoned and heavily damaged tent on the slopes of Dead Mountain. On February 27th, 1959, the first bodies were discovered. Those of Yuri Doroshenko and Yuri Kravonishenko, near the remains of a makeshift campfire.
Get it together, Chris. Get it together,
Chris. I'm
trying,
asshole.
Russian is hard. I know, Russian is hard.
Yeah, that's why from the Cyrillic to the pronunciations, I commend anyone that is not a native speaker that can learn any of those languages. Like Russian, Croatian, Serbian, all that stuff that uses Cyrillic.
The only thing you need to know in Russian are two phrases.
Нет.
Yeah. Я не знаю and я не понимаю. Я не знаю is, shit, which one is which? Hold on. Я не знаю means I don't know. And я не понимаю means I don't understand. That's all you need to know. Sorry, I only speak English.
You probably got that like completely wrong, and you said I'm just a dumb American.
Yeah.
So they found the body of these two hikers, and they were barefoot and dressed only in their underwear, suggesting that they fled the tent in a hurry. Now, why would that be the case? On March 2nd of 1959, the remaining bodies were found in a ravine about 75 meters from the campsite. Some had severe injuries, including fractured skulls, broken ribs, but oddly enough, no external wounds.
Way to whitewash it, man. Jesus. There's so much more to the story. Yeah, I just
gave you a timeline. Now go into further detail.
I was joking, I was gonna say you just want to win this conversation about how nothing happened and there's nothing more to the story. You're just whitewashing it. But you skipped over a really crucial fact that I think is probably one of the most interesting aspects of the story. And that is that the tent was apparently, it seemed like the tent was cut from the inside, right?
Right.
So they were inside the tent, presumably, I'm guessing at dusk, middle of the night, could have been early morning, whatever. They were still in the tent all together. They weren't quite put together yet to go out and do whatever. So they were in there and suddenly they left in a hurry. And the reason why people think they left in a hurry is not just because the tent was cut from the inside. They also left with some of, like they left without their shoes. Some of them left without their shoes on. Some of them left poorly clothed. In a nutshell, it looked like they needed to get out of that tent in a hurry. However, there were no signs that there was anything in the tent that could harm them. There were, like, in terms of, like, you know, gas or fire or something like that. So the tent, other than the gas, is intact, right? And they go outside. And what's the next thing you would assume what would happen if they were running out in a hurry? They would scatter, right? Apparently that didn't happen. Apparently when the search party came and found the campsite, they were able to look at the footprints and they discerned from the footprints that the people who left from that gash in the tent were all traveling in a straight line, right? So I honestly don't give like too much credence to the idea that they would only scatter if they were really freaked out. I think it's still possible that they could have been very freaked out and trying to escape something and they were just traveling, following somebody in a straight line. But a lot of people try to say that the fact that they were traveling in a straight line and that's what their footprints, I would be more interested to find out, which we couldn't find out because it didn't, that information wasn't out there. I would be interested to find out, like, what was the spacing of the footprints? Did it look like they were running? Were they jogging? Were they just straight up walking in a line? And I think that is a crucial piece of information that's missing that would really help develop the story. But if you don't find that particularly interesting, the next part of the story should really catch your attention. And that's when the bodies started to be discovered. One of the first bodies to, or the first body to be discovered under a tree was Yuri Durashenko's body. And this body was particularly strange because it wasn't just bloodied. He didn't just have a severe chest injury. He also had gray fluid coming from his mouth. And what I heard from my, or what I found in my research is that that is kind of indicative of somebody who had some blunt force trauma to their internal organs. So some people like to say, like, oh, maybe he tried to climb the tree and he fell out of the tree. But as we'll see later, more of the bodies actually ended up having this blunt force trauma to the chest that was in line or similar to like somebody being hit with a car. So something that couldn't be, you know, caused from a human being.
So like you were saying, Igor's body, his body was one of the first to be discovered, found lying on his back near a cedar tree, like you just said, about 300 meters from the campsite. And what's interesting is, like you pointed out, no external signs of trauma or anything. So with Igor's body, they presumed that his cause of death was just exposure, possibly hypothermia. With Durashenko, did you mention that he was only in his underwear?
No, I didn't mention that. That's crazy. Jesus.
Yeah. So he was only in his underwear, indicating that he fled the tent in a state of undress. Durashenko had sustained severe frostbite to his extremities, and his autopsy revealed internal injuries consistent with blunt force trauma. Some sources suggest that his injuries were particularly severe, with evidence of significant soft tissue damage. The other Yuri was discovered near Durashenko, also only dressed in his underwear. He also had severe extensive frostbite and exhibited signs of blunt force trauma, including a fractured skull.
Yeah, one more crazy thing about his body, the other Yuri's body, which his last name was Krivonoshenko.
Yep, that's who I'm talking about.
Okay. Yuri, yeah. Krivonoshenko, he actually also, strangely enough, had a chunk of his own knuckle in his mouth. And if you make a fist, like if you're listening to this, make a fist, look at your knuckles. It's very pronounced. It's not just the fact that, I mean, that's cartilage, right? So like if you bit your own knuckle, the force that you would have to impart onto your own skin, it would just be so intense to snap off that cartilage. I cannot, because I think like a lot of us, like, you know, we've had moments in our lives where like maybe we're frustrated, or like, they, you know, that old, you know, comic chestnut about biting your lip or whatever, and you're upset. But like, that's one thing. When you bite your hand, if you're upset, you're not breaking skin. But I think most of us don't know what it's like to really bite hard enough to break any skin, including our own. So for him to have that force of biting off his own knuckle, that's just, damn, like, that's, he must have been under some serious distress that we really can't imagine. So I think that even if he did die from hypothermia, or, you know, maybe he was one of the postulations or the speculations of that is that he was under such pain that he was just trying to distract himself from the pain. But if you're in so much pain that you're biting off your own knuckle, that, I don't know. I can't imagine. I've been in like 10 out of 10 pain before, with like all kinds of issues over the years, like, you know, at least a couple of times in my life, I never wanted to bite my own knuckle off. So I guess maybe he underwent some stress that was way greater than I can imagine, or there was something else going on, either duress or for some reason he felt the need to bite himself like that.
Yeah, dude. And what's even crazier is that the autopsy revealed that his tongue was missing, but we could get into that later when we talk about our theories. The next body that was found was Lyudmila Dubanina's body. Her body was found farther from the campsite, buried under several feet of snow in a ravine. Ding, ding, ding. Several feet of snow. She was dressed in more clothing than some of the other victims, but still not adequately dressed for the extreme cold. Her injuries were among the most severe, with multiple fractures to her skull, ribs, pelvis. Her tongue was also missing, similar to Krivonoshenko. And additionally, she had suffered extensive soft tissue damage to her face and her hands.
Every time I hear this example about, you know, how there's abrasions or injuries to the hands, the legs, I mean, some of these hikers, when they were found, they had their clothes torn. They had bruises that looked like they were indicative of a baton strike or some kind of heavy stick strike. I mean, there was clearly some kind of scuffle going on, because even the guy who was leading the entire expedition, when he was found, that's Igor Dyatlov. Yeah, Igor Dyatlov. His fists were clenched, apparently, and he had abrasions and bruises on several points of his body, and he was actually missing his incisor. And I never thought of this before, but I guess when you're missing a piece of your incisor, it's kind of an indication you took some blunt force trauma to the face, and that could be indicative of being in a fist fight or some kind of like really heavy fighting with your hands or a weapon or whatever, like blunt weapons. So what the hell, man? I mean, there you go. Like, okay, so either somebody went nuts on this trip, like one of the nine hikers went crazy, or they were fighting with someone or something else. And I know one of your theories is, oh, it was, you know, it was just animal attacks or something like that. But I feel like an animal is not going to punch somebody in the face.
Yes, I have another thought about that.
Man. Like, okay, like, I'll take a pause here because I want to hear, we'll go back into the bodies in a second, but what's your thought on that?
I'll save that for when we get there.
Okay, when we get there. Yeah. Okay, so some of the other bodies that they found, the one thing that sticks out to me, as I said earlier, is they have this blunt force trauma to the chest, right? And some of them have internal bleeding that does not indicate that there's any external force, which is so strange to me. Like, if there's no external force, how do you account for all of the internal blood that is pooled in their bodies and stuff like that? And presumably while they're still alive. And I guess one theory could be like, oh, some of them were missing their tongues. Maybe the tongues were cut out or bit out or whatever, and the bleeding resumed or presumed to go down their stomach into their organs or whatever. Who knows how that could have happened? But some of the strange things, like the fractures and the missing eyes, especially in the missing eyes and the missing lips, the missing tongues, it's kind of strange that they don't ever talk about how the tongues were removed, how the eyes were removed. I think that if they were removed surgically, it would have been annotated like that. Like, oh shit, there's an actual clear blade that was used to cut surgically these organs out, or these parts of the body out. But we don't see that, right? They just kind of say, oh, they're missing. Do you have any theories on that? On any theories like how why was it just the tongues, and why, if it was animals taking the body parts, why was it just the tongues and why was it just the eyes? Why not the nose? Why not other parts of the body on the outside?
Aliens.
Aliens.
I'm kidding. No. Like I said, I'll give you my theory when we get to the potential theories that folks have come up with for this incident. Okay. So we talked about Dubonina's body. The next body that was found alongside her was Alexander Kolevatov. He had sustained multiple fractures, including to his skull and ribs. His autopsy also revealed signs of internal bleeding and soft tissue damage. Zenaida, her body was found near Alexander's with similar injuries consistent with blunt force trauma, fractures to her skull, and as well as internal bleeding. Rustem Slobodin, his body was discovered on the slope between the campsite and the cedar tree. So he had sustained several injuries, including a fractured skull and broken ribs. His injuries are consistent with those of a high-speed impact or fall. So this might be a case of maybe him trying to climb a tree or something like that, lost his footing, and just fell and died. The next person was Georgi Krivonoshenko, who was the brother of Yuri Krivonoshenko, was found closer to their campsite, indicating that he may have attempted to return to the tent after fleeing. He also suffered injuries consistent with blunt force trauma, including a fractured skull and broken ribs. A lot of fucking fractured skulls, man. And the last person that they found was Nikolai Thibodeau Brignoli. His body was discovered alongside Georgi's with similar injuries. He had also sustained fractures to his skull and ribs, likely caused by a significant impact. So, do you have anything else to add to that, or do you want to segue to the theories that of what potentially happened to these people?
No, I think you captured it pretty well. And there is one more thing I want to highlight to the listeners to make sure that they're aware of it. But one key aspect is several of the bodies that were found, they appeared to have died relatively quickly, right? So like when they found some of these bodies, they succumbed to their injuries not too long after trying to escape the tent. But the reason why that's important is because they found other bodies that appear to have been alive for longer. And one of the reasons that is theorized is because the bodies of the people who supposedly survived longer had some of the clothing from the people who had died quicker, right? So like, I guess maybe they found the bodies the way they were, or maybe as it suggested, they all tried to get out of the tent quickly. So maybe they went in different directions at one point, but for some reason, some of the bodies just did not survive as long as the other. Some of the people didn't survive as long as the others, right? So I think that's strange. I think it's strange that whatever thing forced them all to deviate from their regular hike, their regularly scheduled hike, there was something that really pushed them to try to survive and separate, not only just survive, but separate, right? So when they found, but then they ended up finding the bodies of the original people who died, and they took the clothing off of them. So you also have to account for the fact that there was another part of that party who lived for longer, and they lived off of the untimely death of the other people in the sense that they took their goods and things that kept them alive or were meant to keep them alive. So I don't know. I just think that's probably an important aspect that we didn't touch on yet, but that's the last one I have.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point that some of them were more well clothed with, which would indicate that, you know, they took clothes from the bodies or maybe even went back and got some clothes. Who knows? But the theories and speculation of what happened to them. So I'm going to start off with the animal attack theory. What are your thoughts on them being attacked by an animal? So I'm thinking if they were attacked by an animal, the only thing that could cause this much havoc to me would be a bear. Once you start running from bears, they're just hell-bent on getting you, because at that point, it's the thrill of the hunt for them. And I think, like, if you take a swipe from a bear, it'll, like, shatter your fucking bones. Like, that's how strong they are. Getting hit by a bear, I wouldn't be surprised if that'll, like, shatter your skull, break your ribs. So what are your thoughts on a potential animal attack theory?
Here's the reason why I don't think it was a single or even a pack of animals, because you're still talking about a group of people who number close to 10, right? So you have like, what was it? Like eight people on a hike. I think that any group of people that size, it seems unlikely that an animal would want to attack such a big group of individuals, right? So when you think about, like, you've seen videos, right? Like, we've all seen videos where people are being attacked by bears and they throw up their hands and scream and shout and make all kinds of screeches and stuff. These are experienced hikers. They would know how to deal with a potential animal attack. And they would also know that the fact that they were in such a large group drastically increased the chances that they would be able to stave off such an attack. I guess unless maybe it was a pack of wolves, but I don't think a pack of wolves can punch them and all of them in the chest so hard that it looks like a car crash. So when it comes to the idea that it was a bear attack, I don't know. Like, think about the fact that even if you had a couple bears, which, and if my crude understanding of nature and stuff like that, I don't think bears really travel in packs. They travel individually, right? So you're talking about four, I think at least four, if not even five of the bodies had blunt force trauma to the chest. And by the way, a lot of them, if not all of them, didn't have any bruising on their chest apparently, which indicates that the trauma had to have come from some other angle or even internally, which is very strange. So if you have a bear, even if the bear attacked one or two people, if they attacked one or two people and had the blunt force trauma in the chest, then maybe. But the fact that it was like a lot of them, to me, that's like, oh, the bear would have had to have systematically gone through and hunted down a lot of them individually. That doesn't sound very indicative of what a bear would normally do, especially a brown bear. Or was it a brown bear, right? Not a black bear? Brown bear. Okay. So brown bears, like, I think they're a little more aggressive than black bears, like Kodiak bears. I think it's the same thing as a brown bear, but they're like very big, right? So like, they're like, if they stand on their hind legs, they could be like 7+ feet tall. But even though they're extremely strong, I still don't think that they would systematically go through. And the last thing to consider with an animal attack is if it was a bear, they would presumably, and it was hunting them, right? It would presumably have consumed them more right. So than the bodies were found. So right. that's the next strongest thing. So think about, before I turn it back over to you, think about two things. The first thing is that if they were attacked by animals that of that size to create such blunt force trauma, then that animal should theoretically have consumed a lot of them, because or much of their bodies, because it would have been hunting them at that point. Because animals don't go after retribution. They go after for food or to protect their area. But if they want to protect their area, why would they hunt them down so ferociously?
Or so, maybe, I don't know. Maybe, like, you brought up a good point, especially with bears. Bears are very territorial. And God forbid you run into a mother bear that has cubs and you sure. are in their territory, they will fuck you up.
Yeah.
So
regardless maybe, of, yeah, regardless if they're hungry or not.
Yeah. It's more of like a protection type of thing. So I've heard of that, like where female bears that have young, they'll protect, bears in general will protect their territory. So if you're in their territory they'll probably just still try to kill you because they deem you as a threat. So maybe they saw the bear, saw the campsite, heard the commotion, got curious. It's in their territory and was sniffing around the tent. And everybody in the tent was like, fuck, we got to make a break for it. It can't follow all of us. So everybody scatters. And then, like you said, with the injuries of some of the people, like maybe they tried to fight it and got swiped and ended up hitting against something and cracking their skull or got a broken ribs as a result of that. But I know what you're going to say. There's no bruises. There's no abrasions. There's nothing externally.
Not just that, but one more thing that you forgot to mention, which is the tent was still
intact,
largely right? intact, right? Except yeah. for the gash. So if it was a bear poking around, and especially if it was getting aggressive, like, okay, so if the bear was poking around the campsite, I really don't think that experienced hikers would be like, oh, we got to cut a hole in the other side of the tent and get out with our shoes off, you know, as fast as possible. I think that if it were me, and I'm not experienced, if it were me and there was an animal that size sniffing around, I would not be ready to bolt for it yet. I would just be very quiet and I would stay in my tent. But there was no signs of a scuffle of such a large animal from outside of the tent, right? So that's the first thing. And then the second thing to consider is that even when they went back, or some of them tried to go back, or one of them apparently tried to go back to the tent, that is strange, right? Why would they not try to go back in a fashion sooner? Because it seems like they, at least the group that created their own makeshift shelter, the ones that survived for longer, it seems like they knew that they couldn't go back to that location. So something happened there that made them think that, oh, that's going to be targeted again. So when I hear that part of the story, if someone said to me, like, you cannot subscribe to any crazy event that is supernatural or cryptid or whatever, then I would say it could have been the local tribe that was nearby.
You stole my thunder.
Okay.
That's what I was going to get at. No, but okay. Go into it. Yeah.
Let's talk about it. I completely agree with you. Because as I'm sure you came across in your research, actually, I'll toss it back to you. What did they find 100 yards from the tent? They found something related to, do you know what they found 100 yards from the tent that's related to the local tribe?
Drum roll. Tell us.
So apparently they found a crude structure that is similar to, or exactly what the Mansi tribe would use during times of animal ritual sacrifice. So apparently they create these structures that kind of looked like a crude tent without a covering. So like a bunch of sticks put together. And I thought that was, you know, I thought that was strange, right? Like, you know, the fact that this ritual sacrifice shelter came about after, but my mind is spinning in terms of like theory and hypothetical situations and stuff. I don't know if I really believe that the Mansi tribe are purely responsible for the deaths, but I think I have to wonder if they believe that there was some kind of evil force that they had to, you know, stave off. Or some people even throw around the idea of like a Yeti. So Ooh. imagine a situation where they had to appease the Yeti, right? And like maybe when they build that structure that brings the Yetis to, I don't know. I'm going off the rails right now because, you know, it's exciting to talk about. But I want to ask your perspective first. What do you think happened in this situation?
Let me go through some other potential theories that people have come up with. So the one I find the most interesting, aside from the avalanche, because, I mean, if it was an avalanche, right, wouldn't the tent have been buried?
I agree. It makes no sense.
The only thing the avalanche would account for is the blunt force trauma that they experienced.
Right.
But that doesn't explain the dude biting off his fucking knuckle.
Or falling from a tree. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't. So I don't know. I'm hard pressed to not believe that one.
that's low on our list, I think, for sure.
Yeah. I think for me, an animal attack is probably mid of the pack. But again, like they weren't eaten. So territorial bear, maybe, but nothing on the bodies to indicate that they were attacked by an animal. Now, another interesting one is military involvement.
Yes.
That they stumbled across a military site, a secret military site, that led to their deaths because there was presence of radiation on some of the clothing.
Right.
Now, how do we explain that?
I think that I'm not ready to give up on the idea that it was some kind of...
A Yeti?
No. It's always the Yeti.
It was the Mothman.
When that... some random shit like that. Of course, that's how life works. I think that, like, I'm not ready to give up on the idea that it could have been some kind of, like, roving military or KGB or whatever. Like, you know, maybe they knew they're going to be up there and they're going to target them. Okay, that's, I get it. I get why you would think that, but there are so many holes. But not just that, but there are so many holes to that theory. One hole is that there weren't other footprints reported in the area. So presumably if you had a large contingent who was, you know, big enough to do what they did or incite what these people went through, you would see all kinds of other instances of like large machinery tracks or other footprints or whatever. Now, I totally get it. Like, you know, okay, so the KGB, like they could have covered it all up. They could have only released the information that is what we see today. But if that were true, then why would we ever see that there was even any radiation up there? They would have covered that up as well. Unless, you know, of course, the KGB are really good at doing what they do and they slipped a little bit of doubt and information to kind of cover their... Totally possible. But let's not go that deep. I think the idea that it was some kind of roving collective of military or KGB is low based off of all the reasons I listed. And for that reason, I also think it's less likely that it was the Mansi tribe doing it themselves for the same reason, because you know, one thing you said that really piqued my interest is like if they were up there and they came across some kind of military installation or some kind of secret, the Mansi tribe would have also come across that. And I also assume that people, this isn't the first time that people have gone through this pass. I mean, this seems like a rite of passage for taking the next step up in certification, like we talked about earlier. Like they were certification 2, they were trying to get to level 3 for their all-terrain, like hiking certification in Russia or whatever. So I don't think this is anywhere near the first time that people have gone through this area. So that's very strange, right? Like you have a group of people who should have by all means passed through here without any issue whatsoever. And it'd be also interesting to find out how many people have followed the same route to get the same certification after that. Was the route just completely closed? Like if it was the KGB, they would have never let them up there in the first place. They would have cordoned off the area and all that shit. So that, to me, that says that there was some kind of planning. If it was collectively a human effort to do this to these people, then there was planning going on. There was some kind of secrecy going on. Maybe some of them as students knew something they weren't supposed to know from their studies. Maybe some of them were working on a secret project. But if that were the case, why would they not just disappear everything and anything altogether? Why would the KGB not just take everything out of the equation? Why just cut tongues out? Why just cut eyes out?
But I mean, the authorities, after the investigation, they did get rid of a lot of the evidence.
Really? What evidence did they get rid of?
They burnt like whatever they had.
Okay.
Yeah. So anything substantial that would be helpful to us now with our modern technology to help figure out what the fuck happened, it's gone. And I think the most that we have are pictures. I don't think we even have like articles of their clothing or anything like that.
See, that's interesting though too, that they had cameras at the campsite that they found and they decided to release the photos.
Yep.
They could have easily just, whoever was in control of this could have easily just said, oops, there's no camera. Oops, there's no photos. You know, why? I mean,
that would be disingenuous because it's already known what they had. Like, see, they probably would have had a ledger.
That's super interesting you bring that up because the way this is playing out in my mind, it does actually at this point in time, after saying that, seem like there's some fabrication or twisting of the facts going on, because you're talking about a situation where just enough information is being let out to the public, but a lot of it is being held back. So that is why I think that something, especially with the fact that there was radiation at the site detected, that's why I think there's more to this story than just a really unfortunate circumstance. But I also don't know why or how or whatever reason that this stuff would have been covered up, especially for so long. I mean, presumably it's 1959, like something would have come out between now and then. But I haven't come across anything that is just crazy, off the walls, indicative of something more than just a death of a bunch of hikers.
See, now you had my mind running, and I personally thought it was probably like an avalanche or something like that. But now you got me thinking. I'm more on your side now, that there was something a little more extra going on. Now, I want to know, like, you're genuine, because you've been alluding to what you think it is. Please share that with me, because I'm kind of curious of what you think happened to them.
I'll give you two answers. The first answer is like so wild, it's like so movie-esque that it should never exist, and people are going to think I'm insane for positing this idea.
What's funny, it's probably the real thing.
Right? That's how life works, man. It just gets you every single time, the last thing you expect. I think that in the wildest dream of the situation I'm thinking of, it's like think about this. The Manti tribe occupied that area for potentially hundreds, if not more, of years, like a long, long, long time. So they know the area.
Yep.
They know every inch of that area. They know the wildlife. They know what the wildlife's capable of, all that stuff. Yet they also apparently, I don't know if this is true or not, because this is just something I came across in terms of, you know, tertiary information, but apparently they have ritualistic sacrifices, which it does not include humans, obviously. So I'm assuming that the sacrifice would be of animals, which, as we know, a lot of people in human history have done that. So they create these structures, one of which, as we mentioned, were found near the campsite. In my wildest imagination, I would think that, like, it's possible that there was some creature or some force that they needed to appease in order to keep living up there, sustaining their way of life. And they knew that eventually some group of hikers would come through there, as they always do, because this isn't something new. This isn't a new past that someone is suddenly discovering. They probably get hikers going through that area dozens of times, if not more, per year. So this is just one unfortunate group of people who got pegged for a ritualistic sacrifice. Whether or not the people actually, the tribe actually did the sacrifice, that's one thing. I mean, if you want to be more materialistic and think like it's possible, you know, it's not, there's nothing metaphysical going on. There's nothing superstitious or anything going on. It's just like they're just trying to appease the gods that they don't see, sort of thing. Then maybe some of the Mansi did kill these hikers and go through this ritualistic sacrifice. But in my wildest dreams, I think it's fun to think that maybe there is like a Yeti clan or some kind of like supernatural cryptid entity clan up there that they need to appease in order to survive close by. So they built this structure and they're like, okay, here you go, Yeti clan. Here's your ritualistic sacrifice for the next 50 years to let us live up here and not attack us. And then suddenly all these people get blunt force trauma to the chest, tongues cut out, eyes cut out, or eyes missing, all this other shit. Like, I can't imagine a situation in which hypothermia would completely disintegrate your lips and eyes in a matter of like a week or two. We know that's not possible. I mean, we find bodies that are in permafrost, not just human bodies, but like animal bodies in permafrost, where they still have a lot of their organs visible, even if they're dehydrated. So for the eyes to be completely missing, for the tongue to be completely missing, to have internal bleeding, just does not make any fucking sense whatsoever. Something had to have done this to them to that degree. And that is my wildest, probably tinfoil hat speculation, that the Mansi tribe was somehow involved in this ritualistic sacrifice that was appeasing some malevolent force or Yeti tribe or something like that. That's one side. Okay, I know that was a long tirade. I'm not going to go in the same length of tirade real quick. But the other side is, have you ever heard of infrared sound? Infrasound. Have you ever heard of that term?
Why don't you explain it to us?
Okay. Infrasound is sometimes referred to as low frequency sound. It basically describes a sound wave that has a frequency that's like very, very low, below the human audibility capability, like the ability for humans to hear. It's such a low frequency that we can't pay attention to it with our ears. It has to be felt, right? So there's one study to suggest that infrasound can actually cause feelings of awe or fear or something supernatural or odd going on. And it's just, it's interesting that that is one of the theories that are postulated. Like, why would somebody put themselves through the situation that these people put themselves through when there's seemingly nothing else out there to make them freak out or run away from their tent or cut a hole in the tent or whatever? So it's very possible that maybe it was the military or the KGB testing some kind of technology such as infrasound that actually drove these people insane. Why would they choose to target these people instead of, say, the Mansi tribe? Because people study the Mansi tribe. The Mansi tribe, they have been around for such a long time that if they suddenly targeted them, there would be some questions as to whether, why would a tribe so embedded in this area suddenly succumb to the elements or whatever explanation that they made up. So in that case, they would focus on a group of hikers who were intermediate level, who were students, who most people wouldn't bat an eye at, who died in this circumstance. So that's why I think the other side of the equation could very well be military testing, government testing, something that was targeting them from the human side. What do you think about that?
To be honest with you, I like your sacrifice idea, that it's something cryptid, paranormal, that was responsible for this. But again, with the appearance of radiation, the discovery of radiation on the clothing, it's you gotta lean towards some sort of military experiment, because if you think about it, like, why wouldn't they choose them? You're in the middle of a fucking pass.
Yeah.
You are hundreds of miles away from civilization. There are so many things that could have happened to the group that cost them their lives. And to me, that would be very easy to cover up. Because honestly, you could say, okay, it was an avalanche. That's why they were buried under all the snow. That's why some of them were buried. You could use a multitude of excuses of why these hikers died. I don't think that one of the theories was paradoxical undressing, that they succumbed to hypothermia and then just started fist fighting each other and all this crap. Like,
they had a fire in their tent. No way.
No fucking way. That I don't believe. So it's one of two things. It's either something cryptid paranormal that happened to them, or it was a military cover-up in which they wanted to test something. And what better group to do it to than a group of hikers that are slightly off course next to a place called Dead Mountain? I mean, I don't know where else to go with this, because we already ruled out the animal attack. We already ruled out the avalanche, because nothing was, like, the tent was still intact, like nothing was buried or anything like that.
Right.
It's not hypothermia causing them to go crazy and go wild on each other. So it's either something, some force of nature that we're not aware of, that the Mansi tribe are aware of, that killed these people, or, which this would make more sense, is some sort of military involvement. In the sense that after the investigation was over, they got rid of like 99% of the evidence. Why would you do such a thing?
Right.
What are you trying to hide? So to me, the logical route says if there was some sort of secret military involvement, or Yetis whooped their asses and killed them. Or aliens.
You said it. You finally said it. I think we, okay. I feel like I can feel the collective force of all the people listening to this conversation. By the way, if you're still listening, God bless you, because this has been a hard one to talk about. But I feel like the people who are listening know of this story. They're like, how can you talk about this without talking about extraterrestrial? So yeah. I'm going to toss it back to you real quick, because you're the one who said you have seen this story come up on like ancient aliens and all that stuff. And I don't remember that. So like, what are some of the theories about why it would have been alien? Like, it doesn't make sense. I think I would even rate alien involvement lower than like a bear attack. Cause yeah. why would aliens, like, why wouldn't they just systematically take them all out at once or do whatever? Like, why would they cut out their tongues and their eyes? Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
I think it's mainly due to trying to relate it back to the animal bodies that we found, where like they would find livestock with like missing eyes and tongues and organs and whatnot. So I think that's where the whole alien stuff came from, with specifically with ancient aliens. They think that, you know, the aliens were probably experimenting on them, and they were out in the middle of nowhere, so they were an easy target. So let's go ahead and do what we need to do, and whatever, who cares? Aliens are at the bottom of my list. So it's either like the Yeti, or, which is more logical, because the authorities destroyed all of the evidence, probably some sort of military involvement, in which they were experimenting on some sort of weapon or something like that, that they didn't want the public to get wind of, or anyone to do any type of investigations or research on the evidence that they gathered.
Completely agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Because as we know, like the militaries in general have all of this like technology they're always testing. They always are looking to develop advanced weaponry. And if you look into the past, some of like the declassified things like MK Ultra and all that crap, like it's not out of the realm of possibility that these people were unfortunately targeted just because they were at the right place at the wrong time.
One last thing to consider with this whole question about what happened to them is, in going off of what you just said, I think is spot on. I think that I would personally lean more towards the idea that this is like some kind of unfortunate wrong place at the wrong time sort of thing, with, in terms of like military testing and whatnot, because you're talking about 1959, which is still very much during the Cold War. And you have the United States against the Soviet Union, which we've been saying Russia this whole time. It's really the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was trying to create anything and everything they possibly could to counter the United States and the capabilities that the U.S. had in terms of nuclear arms reach and all that stuff. So you're talking about a time of like mutually assured destruction, where both sides were armed with nuclear weapons, but at the same time, they're always trying to get an edge off, getting an edge off of each other. So I do think that, but isn't that fascinating though? Like, that's like you're talking about a situation that is historically relevant to a time in which we could have seen the destruction of all of humanity. And these people were either the brunt of some test, or they stumbled across something that they weren't supposed to. Or I even think it's possible that we're talking about students, right, from a good university. Maybe one of them were involved in some sort of study, or maybe one of them made some kind of discovery. And the only way to eliminate that is to make it seem like this person perished in some kind of hiking accident. Because think about it, like if people found the bodies with like bullet holes in the back of their head, it's gonna raise way more questions. So I don't know. I think there's some kind of experimentation thing angle going on, or some kind of cover up discovery thing going on, or some kind of testing. I think that while I like the romantic idea that it could have been some Yeti clan being appeased right by the local Mansi tribe, I think it's probably the fucking KGB, which is always, it's always the KGB. It's always the KGB. KGB does all the bullshit in the world.
You know, to go off of that, maybe these students plan to leave the Soviet Union.
Mm. Where are the Ural Mountains exactly in terms of other countries around? Are there any countries nearby? I don't have the map pulled up right now.
So, like, the closest country to the Ural Mountains would be Kazakhstan.
Who wants to flee to Kazakhstan? Ugh. Just kidding. I love you, Kazakhstan. I love you, Kazakhstan.
But if you think about it, like, I knew a professor that lived in the Eastern Bloc. And when him and his wife would try to, essentially, from what he told me, the way that people would get out is that they would go on a vacation to the beach in Croatia. And then from there, they'd like hop over to Italy and just get the hell away from Soviet sphere of influence. And when you would go, like, you would have to go to some government office and declare where you're going, yada, yada, yada. They would ask, why do you want to go to a Croatian beach when we have beaches here, like on the Black Sea and stuff like that? So I wouldn't be surprised as them being academics at a polytechnical institute, they probably want to go somewhere where they would have more flexibility of what they studied without, you know, a potential target on their back. And maybe they discovered something. Yeah, maybe they discovered something that was off within, who knows, the KGB or the government, or something that the government was doing incorrectly that they knew and could potentially be exposed. Like, who knows? It could be a whole plethora of things. And that's one reason why I think they would be targeted. I mean, students, intelligent students, polytechnical school, I mean, they're bright minds. And if they even thought of defecting to the West, like, why wouldn't you take them out? Like, why not?
And one extra consideration for that is like, well, what we're not saying is that they were on this expedition to escape, right? Because they're in the middle of Russia,
right,
on a
right
hike.
No.
But we're trying to say is, like, if you're trying to fabricate an escape from Soviet Russia, because you know some information and you're smart, you're going to do it in a way that is surreptitious and quiet and
right
drawn out. You're not going to suddenly just flee, right? So it's very possible that they... And when we say they, it doesn't have to be, it's, of course, it's almost certainly not every single student. It's maybe
it could
like
have been
two
just
or three.
Or, yeah.
Everybody else was just cut up in the crossfire. Now, if that were true, and I have to be perfectly honest with everybody, one of the things, and this is kind of terrible to say, I don't want to say that it's certain. I just want to put it out there as a possibility. But isn't it interesting that the one guy who suddenly got medical issues separated from the group? And he knew where they were going to be. He knew the location, all that stuff. and he had to confirm that they were actually going to be up there.
Right.
So I think if I were ever going to start an investigation, like a real actual investigation into something like this, I would start with that guy, because that's like, you know, he had the inside information. He's the one who survived, you know, maybe like is there anything, who knows? Maybe he was an ultra rich kid who was like, he completely was pissed off at like most of the people of that group. And he's like, you know what? I am better than all these people. I'm just going to have them killed. I know that's terrible. This guy probably was not like that.
Right.
But just saying, you know, like you never know what the situation is, but you always got to look at all the angles, including the person who seemed to have survived unscathed. I would start there.
Yeah. And why would he knowingly agree to go on this hiking trip when he has rheumatoid arthritis? Like, he knows he has all these, this plethora of health issues.
No.
Why would you even entertain the possibility of going when you know you wouldn't be able to? So,
right.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. I think you bring up a good point. But final word on this, man. What do you think it was? I'm leaning more towards some sort of military involvement.
Yeah, I think so as well, because the one thing that keeps coming back to my mind unintentionally, that it just keeps popping back in there, the fact that they cut their way out of the tent, but they walked in a straight line. They weren't running sporadically. They weren't trying to seemingly escape some wild animal or something. They seemed to have been led in a certain direction. That's just, to me, honestly, man, like that, I'm so stuck on that. That's the strangest thing to me ever, that they would be in a straight line trying to get away from something in the tent so quickly. To the point where they're not wearing, some of them are not wearing shoes and not adequately clothed. This is one of the greatest mysteries we've ever discussed, because you have an actual tangible event with documented evidence of what happened. But everything seems to have been playing out in such a way that just does not make sense, right? That is why I've just in this last couple seconds decided that I'm with you. I think it's like, you know, almost certainly some kind of military related or organized concentrated effort to either systematically kill or test or whatever, like put upon these people, because there are so many questions and avenues that you can think of and postulate of what's actually happening. I think if you had really smart people, they would create a situation where you're not sure which direction the theory is going to go. You're literally muddying the water to what's possible. You have the Mansi tribe. You have the possibility of animal attack. You have the possibility of extraterrestrial attack. You have the possibility of, you know, the actual, what we think happened, the KGB military attack. There's so many possibilities based off of what actually happened and the way things are laid out that it almost seems too perfect. You know, it's too perfectly muddied. And that's why I think that there's some kind of intelligent design behind what really happened. And I would not put it past the KGB of the 1959 era.
Yeah. Maybe they even did have someone on the inside.
Yeah.
Of the group.
Or that... not even the GRU. Let's throw some shade to the GRU, or not the KGB. Could also be the GRU. GRU is military intelligence.
But yeah, I think we're in consensus that probably some sort of military involvement that led to their demise. But yep, we'll never know.
Until the KGB comes for us.
You're stumbling across a secret.
Unless we get a chronovisor and can take a look.
The Vatican and the Russians and the Soviets, it's all connected.
It's like that meme with the guy with the board. He has like the thing in his hand and his hands are up in the air, like connecting all of these freaking dots. That's probably
Pepe Silvia. Pepe Silvia. It's all about Pepe Silvia. This is where we end up in a straitjacket and we're like, it was the Russians and Pepe Silvia and the Catholic Church.
And we're going to cut ourselves off, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed talking about it.
Thanks for putting up with our bullshit.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode of The Wandering Road. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a rating on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please share the show with your friends, as that would help us grow immensely. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on TikTok at TWR Podcast, our Instagram at TW Road Podcast, and our Facebook by searching for The Wandering Road Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can reach us at our email address, twroadpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We would love to have you on the show as a guest so you can share your stories, or you could submit email submissions of your stories that we could dedicate an episode to. Thanks, and we'll catch you on the next one.